QuantSpeak, expert insights from quants for quants.
Welcome to QuantSpeak, a new podcast from the CQF Institute at Fitch Learning.
Hi, I'm Dan Tudball, editor of Wilmot Magazine, and this is QuantSpeak. The London Wales saga concluded catastrophically in 2012, costing JP Morgan $6.2 billion in losses. At every level, from regulatory and corporate oversight, through reporting and conflicts of interest, to pricing choices and risk management, it's a masterclass in how not to get things done. In this edition of QuantSpeak, I'm joined by Professor Natalie Packham. We'll be talking about Natalie's work on correlation stress testing of stock and credit portfolios and why the London Whale portfolio is a great case study for this novel approach to risk management. Discussing the driving concept of linking economically meaningful scenarios to correlation scenarios, why risk management in the London Whale case was so deficient, the advantages of a correlation stress testing approach, and how the culture of the finance industry could actually be risk management's biggest challenge. Well, I hope we'll have enough time to cover all of that in one conversation. So without further ado, welcome, Natalie.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for making the time to speak with us. So Natalie's going to be presenting a talk for the CQF Institute on recent research focusing on correlation stress testing of stock and credit portfolios. And what we're hoping to do today is just have a chat around the themes that are involved in that particular topic, hopefully serve as a way to whet people's appetite to actually attend the talk or watch the video. But at the same time, we'd like to explore the themes that arise from this particular set of research. So maybe just to kick things off, it would be great, Natalie, if you could sort of summarize your view on that particular incident, and we can look into that a little bit before we start talking about how your correlation approach may well have actually helped in avoiding the entire situation in the first place.
About the London Whale, just to give a very brief background, the London Whale refers to a loss of approximately accumulated $6.2 billion. That occurred in 2012 at JP Morgan. And as you all know, JP Morgan is the bank that first came up with the concept of valued risk. So it's a bank that's very renowned for its risk management.
Rather ironic.
In a way, because what's special about the London Whale case, as opposed to other incidents that have losses of that order coming from a single trader or a single trading desk, what's special here is that it's not a case linked to fraud or criminal activity. Other losses, for instance, several years ago, Société Générale, they are cases where a single trader or a team of traders, they hide losses. But here it's different. Everything was open, and so everything, the portfolio was under the observation of the risk management operations. So this makes it a particularly interesting case from a risk management analysis perspective. So why could such a loss occur then? There's one thing that's special about the portfolio. The portfolio was not within the investment banking division, which has its own risk management system. It was in the located within chief investment office, which right. ran a separate risk management system. So from that perspective, one could assume that maybe what happened would not have been possible if it had been within the investment banking division.
So it wasn't a client-facing division of the bank. This part of the bank was really tasked with looking after the risk figures for the entire enterprise, really.
As I understand the Chief Investment Office, and in particular that trading desk, they were, it was their job to invest surplus deposits. So it wasn't a very large operation as such.
Mm.
And so what they did, they set up a synthetic credit derivatives portfolio consisting of Itrax, North American credit derivatives, in order to generate some return on those surplus deposits.
The North American index was the CDX index.
It's the CDX index. That's right.
And talking about the time that they set this up, it was actually just before the subprime crisis, yes. And this whole episode, if you will, played out over a course of 4 years before finally accumulating in this $6.2 billion loss. One of the things that I found interesting was that at the outset, which was why I found it quite ironic, was that this was the period of time when Basel III was in the offing and JP Morgan was attempting to get its house in order, really, before the new regulations came into place. And initially, this trade was set up mainly with the purpose of reducing the risk exposure for the entire bank. But when profits started to pour in, and it was evident that this particular strategy in its first couple of years was rather timely and producing excellent returns, the emphasis somewhat shifted away towards the profit related aspect of things.
Mm-hmm.
You were actually working in the industry before going into academia full time, so I guess tackling this particular topic as somebody who's been both on both sides of the fence, as it were, does it sort of produce memories or recall in terms of your own experience on the industry side? The bad old days.
The bad old days. Well, back when I was in the industry, that was in the early 2000s, I was located at the front office. And, I didn't have a lot to do with risk management. I mean, I did have a lot to do with risk management because we were under the observation of risk management, but we didn't ourselves really take a risk management perspective. So thinking that the way of thinking at the front office is really about generating profit, and it's one of those things where I learned later from studying different cases and from having a broader view when I was back in academia, is the importance of risk management is really not only on the bank-wide level, but even on a society's level. It's in the society's interest.
Certainly.
But this is not the way that traders think, and to some extent, it's not the way they're supposed to think. They are supposed to be profit oriented. So I really see that risk management should be on the same level as trading operations. It should be. Back when I was in the industry, risk management was considered middle and back office, and in a way, we thought of risk management as being a nuisance. I mean, they were more or less standing in our way when we didn't want them to stand in our way. But with hindsight, I can't stress how important it is to have a good and sound risk management. So you need powerful people, and you need people who take on the responsibility. So they should be on the same level in every respect with trading operations. They should be able to step in, and they should also be confident enough to be able to step in and not worry about risking their job if they don't step in when they know they should be stepping in.
Certainly. I mean, this particular JP Morgan case, there are so many people involved, and some of them we actually know personally, and we actually know that they're good eggs, actually. You know, it's a matter of the culture and the pressures that are in there in that sort of situation that lead to these sorts of errors. Now, going back to that period of time and coming round to your research as well, as we said, at the center of this whole thing is this synthetic credit portfolio. And one of the issues, of course, was that the checks and balances that are meant to be in place just weren't there in terms of oversight internally, as well as regulatory jurisdiction at that time, really. There was a very sort of gray area as to who was actually responsible for regulating this kind of activity. But on the internal oversight aspect, and coming in closer to your research, what was the typical approach at that point, 2011, 2012, in terms of handling the risk management for a trading book, for a portfolio of this nature? We have value at risk measurements. We have CSW10, which was the other one, which was in application here. But the question is, because you're going to be talking about correlation, was correlation on anybody's radar at that point? Was it really something that people would have thought about at that point as a meaningful way to provide checks and balances?
Well, to answer that question, we may need to go back a bit in time to look at earlier cases.
Okay.
So let me maybe just start out with my former PhD student, now a research assistant, Fabian Weberking. He did a great job in digging through all the publicly available information and documents about the London Whale.
Right.
And because of court hearings and Senate hearings in the US, there's a lot available publicly, and the challenge is really to plow through it and distill the real information that's in there. Now, from what he found is that what was used, at least officially and what's publicly known, was valued risk and the credit spread widening of 10 basis points, which are two standard risk measures to look at in the finance industry, which is also what would usually be reported to from a regulatory point of view. So valued risk measures measures a boundary which tells you what is the bound of loss that is not going to be breached with a certain pre-given probability.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells you your losses are going to stay within that bound with a probability of 99% and only extend that boundary called valued risk with a probability of 1%. This is a standard risk measure in the finance industry. And then on trading desks, of course, you also look at sensitivities such as a credit spread widening, where you just assume that all credit spreads widen by 10 basis points at the same time. That's a
right.
standard sensitivity to look at. Now, if we go back in time, if we look back in time in the late 1990s, 1997, 98, there was a very big loss that was caused by a hedge fund called LTCM, long-term capital management. And yes. This loss has been very well studied because it was one of the first investors who used valued risk as a risk measure to find their optimal portfolio, their optimal asset allocation. And one of the things they ignored, at least from what we know, one of the things they ignored was that the parameters that you use to calculate valued risk might change. They're not fixed. They are dynamic. We're in an economy that is constantly changing, and we don't have a lab environment where we can just assume calibrated parameters, they will stay fixed as they are.
Sure.
And that was one of the reasons why their approach actually didn't work. One of several reasons. So I would assume that everyone will have learned from LTCM, and given that the people who were running the synthetic credit derivatives portfolio, they were professionals. I'd be surprised if they didn't look at other scenarios as well, such as what would happen if volatilities increase, what would happen if correlations break down. But at least it's not officially documented. There's no public hint to that this is what they did. And so it's more or less the question of, were they aware of the additional risks that were not exposed by their valued risk and CSW10 calculations or not?
Right.
I'd be surprised if they weren't. I'd be surprised.
Yes, well, from LTCM, I think the main thing that anybody learned was the phrase too big to fail, but and also the importance of how big your sample period was. But certainly in this case, in terms of the actual actions of the traders in the CIO, the Chief Investment Office at JP Morgan, there wasn't that level of oversight, and there wasn't even a limit in terms of their trade positions, what the maximums were. And also there wasn't even a dedicated risk manager sort of attached to the desk until things started to really look like they were going in the wrong direction. In the usual case, assuming that people aren't marking to market with far more aggressive figures than they ought to be, rather than the midpoint, assuming that people are actually reporting at the right time of day, because I understand that in this particular case, people were sort of hanging on and extending the period out to the and saying, well, London closing was not that great, let's wait till New York closes before we report our value at risk figure, and all sorts of things like that, eventually ending up with the decision to come up with a brand new value at risk model, which would actually report more favorable figures, which then subsequently led on to a sort of a doubling and tripling down on this buy your way out of trouble approach that seemed to be in play at the time. But assuming that hadn't been the case and it was just, okay, let's stick to the accepted approaches of the time, how much additional insight and value would your correlation approach have provided? And this would be a good segue, I think, into correlation techniques in general, how you're tying that into different economic factors. Mm-hmm. And also and we'll talk a little bit about Bayesian approaches as well.
Mm-hmm. So before I talk about correlation, one thing that's important, and that goes back to the first point I made, one thing that's important to understand about the London Whale case is that the portfolio was run by very successful and highly regarded people in the industry.
Mm, yeah.
So So it's naturally hard if you don't install people in risk management who are at par, who are on the same level as those traders and portfolio managers. It is very hard to manage that incentive conflict.
Right.
So and that has always been one of the cornerstones of Basel regulation, is to require institutions to have a separate risk management entity right up into senior management, fully independent. But I think the London Whale example, the London Whale case shows that this is what Basel regulation has been requiring, but it's very hard to really install this in a way that this is lived across the institution.
Right.
Costly to run risk management operations. It's costly. It's a pure cost factor. It's not a profit generating entity, but it resolves an incentive conflict. And it should be aware to anyone in the finance industry that the incentive conflict is not a conflict with regulation, regulatory authorities, external regulators, but it's also an incentive conflict with shareholders and with management. It's also about this, the well-being of the institution that you work for or whose shares you hold, even as an employee. So it's also in the interest of senior management and employees that there's a good risk management. I think this is a fact that's been overlooked by a lot, by a lot of people in the finance industry. I think that's a way of thinking that we need to be aware of, that it's not only society or external regulators, it's really also within the organization. A good risk management will certainly help the organization mid and long term.
For sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, but coming to correlation, well, from our perspective, there are several reasons why the London Whale case was such a brilliant case for studying correlation and correlation scenarios and correlation stress testing. First, because it was a large loss and not a fraud case, so we had something to work on where we had all the information that we needed. We could replicate the portfolio, at least on a particular day, we could replicate the position. But it's also an interesting case because it's a portfolio that is inherently driven by correlation. It's a credit derivatives portfolio with a very large notional, but with a lot of internal hedges. So a lot of positions offsetting each other.
Yep.
So that the actual riskiness measured in something called a unit called risk-weighted assets actually look fairly small.
Right.
Or the valued risk also look fairly small because for instance, within the portfolio, there could be a long position in a particular credit derivative that was investment grade, and an offsetting credit derivatives position with a similar maturity that was high yield.
Right.
And one would say, well, those two would naturally be highly correlated because they only differ in this investment grade versus high yield respect. So they are nice hedges, and that brings down the risk. And having said that, those positions, they nicely hedged each other most of the time, but they were not perfect hedges. So this made it a nice case to investigate, well, what could happen to the portfolio if correlation broke down?
Right.
And that was one of the reasons to study that particular case from the point of view of correlation scenarios and correlation stress testing. Having said that, the correlation or decorrelation problem was not the only problem that the portfolio was facing. It was also, of course, facing with a huge notional liquidity issues and the problem that you would not be able to just eliminate the position in a very short amount of time if you wanted
no,
to.
No, they just found themselves in that pinch all too often and didn't offload those sort of detrimental positions quickly enough and just kept on buying stuff that nobody would ever want to buy off them.
Exactly. So there was a decision by management in late 2011 to reduce the riskiness of the credit derivatives portfolio. Now, there are two ways how you can reduce risk. You can just sell off positions. Quite obviously, that will reduce your risk. Or in the case of this credit derivatives portfolio, you could buy new positions that act as hedges for existing positions. And this is what they chose to do. So they blew up the notional of the portfolio, bringing down the risk-weighted assets. But the risk-weighted assets only ever give you a snapshot of what is your instantaneous risk, but they don't tell you really what is your, looking forward, what is your risk going to be. It's meant to be forward-looking,
right?
But it always uses historical data. And as I said before, there are assumptions such as that the parameters that you put into the model are constant. So the way we looked at it is that we said, well, with those credit derivatives, and that's a third nice factor why it was such a nice case to study, is that the credit derivatives, they have, it's a very homogeneous portfolio in the sense that every single position has a maturity, has it can be investment grade or high yield, is either European or North American. Then there is something called a series in those credit derivatives. So they all have kind of this, the same types of properties and just differ in the actual instance of each of those properties. Sure. So we thought this would be a nice way to link those properties with correlations. So we could play around with scenarios. What happens if correlations between credit derivatives of different maturities change? What happens if there's a decorrelation between European and North American credit derivatives? So we could actually specify correlation scenarios in economic terms. Now I'm stretching the term a bit in terms of those properties of those credit derivatives. So we linked correlation with those properties by borrowing ideas from interest rate modeling. So anyone who's who's been working on for market models such as the LIBOR market model would know that there are some parametric ways of modeling correlations, because a LIBOR market model is a high dimensional interest rate model, because many forward LIBOR rates are modeled simultaneously. So we have to take into account their correlations, but if we just take empirical correlations, we will have lots of parameters, and they're noisy parameters. So it makes sense to come up with some parametric way of modeling correlation.
And this is where Bayesian variable selection methods come in, right?
Not quite yet. So the basic parametric, the simplest parametric correlation model you see in a LIBOR market model is in such a way that it says, well, as if you take two forward LIBORs, if they are far away in terms of their maturities, the correlation should be lower than if they're close. So 5 and 6 year LIBOR rate would have a higher correlation than a 1 and 10 year LIBOR rate, which is kind of a very natural
way makes sense.
So we borrowed that idea and we thought, well, maturity is a distance measure. So maybe we can apply this kind of distance measure to other properties. So we have a distance in terms of, there's a distance if two credit derivatives differ in being investment grade and high yield, as opposed to if they are both investment grade or both high yield. So there's some decorrelation entering if they differ in this respect.
Right.
Or if they if they differ in terms of their geographic regions. So if they are both North American, there will be no decorrelation from the geographic region. But if they differ in terms of being North American European, there will be some decorrelation entering.
Mm.
So we used that parametric form from the LIBOR market model and applied it to the London whale. And this connection allowed us to now make changes to the strength of those decorrelations for various
right.
factors. And the strength of those decorrelations, we calibrated from historical data. So we just took historical data every day, and every day we calibrated the strength of those decorrelation factors, and that gave us a time series of decorrelation factors, so we could actually observe how decorrelation had taken place over time.
Right.
We even had a distribution of those decorrelation factors.
Right.
And that's the basic idea. It's very simple.
And that's at a portfolio-wide level, is it?
Exactly. Exactly. And so what we observed from calibrating those factors is that there had been a strong decorrelation between investment grade and high yield.
Right.
So so with a very simple method, we could observe that decorrelation. And then we could use the historical information to determine scenarios in terms of if we take an extreme scenario from the historical data and apply to today's portfolio, what would happen to the valued risk of that portfolio?
Right, right. Why didn't anybody ever make that connection before?
That's a good question. it's a good question. I wouldn't even claim that nobody's done it. It's hard to say what people do at trading desks, what kind
sure.
of tests they run, but it's not public information, and it's not even maybe available to regulators. So it's it'd be bold to say nobody's doing it. It hasn't been done from an academic perspective. A lot of research effort has gone into modeling dependency through copulas and other means, because we know that correlation is a very simplistic measure of dependence, and it fails
right.
to capture important aspects of dependency as we see it. So there's been a huge progress in dependence modeling, but correlation stress testing, from what we've seen, has not been treated thoroughly before. There are some challenges if you have a large correlation matrix and you make changes to it. You have to make sure that you meet the mathematical requirements of a correlation matrix. So there are some, I would say, technical challenges to that as well.
Mm.
But as far as I know, the link from economic scenarios or from some properties of the assets to correlation scenarios, that's not been studied before.
Interesting. So, you know, you were talking about how you borrowed some ideas from interest rate modeling. One of the areas with interest rate modeling is the sort of early adoption of Bayesian methods. Could you say a little bit about that? Because in terms of the interest rate space, it's not necessarily a novel thing anymore to be talking about Bayesian methodologies. But in this particular aspect, why
yes.
that choice?
Okay. So this would now leave the London whale behind. So we published the paper on the London whale, and we were approached by regulators, and they asked as well, this is a great idea, but it's so tailored to the London whale. How could this approach be used in a more general
right.
setting. So you have a typical loan portfolio, credit portfolio in a financial institution. How could you apply this approach to a general portfolio? So that's how we're leaving the London whale behind, and we started to think about how could this be generalized, this approach. One of the general methods that financial institutions use to measure or to calibrate correlations for large loan portfolios is through something called a factor model. So you have some risk factors, and you determine the correlations of those risk factors, and then the actual loans or assets are linked through those risk factors, and that's how you determine their correlations. Because remember, determining correlations is a very high dimensional problem. It's a huge number of free parameters, and correlations are extremely noisy. They're driven by so many things that if we just measure correlation empirically, we see very weird dependencies a lot of the time. So we want to have a bit of control. So risk factors, factor models are a generally accepted approach, and risk factors would typically be geographic regions and industries. Now, if we just use a general factor model as it is used in the industry, which typically involves regression techniques, we find that every firm is somehow linked to every risk factor. And this is not useful. This is not useful for stress testing. if we say we do a stress test on Finland, and every asset in the world somehow depends on Finland, even if it's just weak, then it's not a stress test on Finland anymore. So, so the idea was to determine what are, for every asset, what are the most important risk factors. So it's a factor selection problem. So instead of using a regression approach, so where people know this is ordinary least squares estimation of parameters, and
right.
you never get a parameter or a coefficient that is zero. So instead of using this, we were looking at factor selection approaches. And many people nowadays will know there are so-called regularization techniques. And one of them that is very suitable for factor selection is called lasso. So this is kind of like a linear equation as you have it in regression, but it's a technique that selects factors and applies zeros to a lot of factors. Now, the additional thing though that we have here is that we know for every firm, there's one particular country, namely where it's headquartered, and one particular industry where we have prior knowledge. And a technique such as lasso would not be able to pick up that prior knowledge. And this is where Bayesian variable selection comes in.
Right.
So the Bayesian variable selection that we employ, we've been playing around with several methods, but the one that we employ is very close to lasso, with the exception that it allows us to use that additional prior knowledge. So we can always make sure that VW is an automotive company located in Germany, even if there are possibly settings where the data would for one quarter suggest something different. And
sure.
this is where the Bayesian variable selection comes in. So what we're really looking at is we want to make the best use of the prior knowledge we have. And then we want to select a few important factors. For instance, we know that VW, it's a German company, but if there's a recession in other economic areas, it'll impact VW as well. So we want to pick up those important factors as well. And this is where the Bayesian variable selection comes in.
Okay.
And then once we have those factors selected, we regularly update them with fresh data, we're back to the method that we employed in the London Whale, where we can now link those risk factors with the correlations of the assets, the firms, or the bonds. And then we can run scenarios, we can do stress testing, and we can even do reverse stress testing. So we could even ask, what is a kind of worst case economic setting for my portfolio?
Okay. Certainly, I'm looking forward to the talk and further explanation of the research process and so on. Is there anything that you wanted to particularly stress on that you think that we might have missed in this conversation?
As far as I see, there hasn't been so much research on this topic. So I'm still very, very, and it's still ongoing research on our side. So if listeners have ideas or suggestions, I'd be very open and welcome to hear them and discuss them. I mean, so far we've been in discussions with various people and stakeholders, but I'm sure there are people out there who have very good ideas or who see nice applications of what we're doing, and I'd be very interested in hearing about those.
That would be great. And we'd love to hear more about developments as this progresses as well. Thanks very much for joining us on our inaugural Quant Speak, Natalie.
And thank you for having me.
As I said, we're looking forward to the talk. And obviously, if you're listening to this after the talk was actually on, you should go along to the CQF Institute, sign up, and you should be able to access the video there. All right. Thanks. Great. Have a great day.
Thank you so much. Have a nice evening.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to QuantSpeak. Don't forget to subscribe and do sign up to the CQF Institute for more insights into quant finance. Mm-hmm.